Lecture 9, Poverty and Inequality.
Poverty and inequality are often lumped together in popular discussions, but they aren't really quite the same thing. Poverty refers to the bottom part of the income distribution. It refers to the people who are below some basic level, and we'll talk about how that level is set a little bit later on. Inequality refers to the entire range of the income distribution, from top to bottom. It's perfectly possible to have a situation where poverty and inequality move in opposite directions. For example, imagine a situation where the top part of the income distribution, the wealthy people, get richer for whatever reason. Their incomes go up. Well, that would increase the amount of inequality in the economy, the rich being richer, but the people below the poverty line might be in exactly the same situation they were before. Similarly, if you think about that in reverse, if the people at the top of the income distribution get poorer, that will mean the income distribution is less unequal. Everyone is closer together, there's more equality. However, poverty could be just the same as it always was. The thing that poverty and inequality both have in common is that markets can create both of them. In any market, if people are paid according to their productivity, according to the forces of supply and demand, according to what's out there in the market, we're going to find out that some individuals are going to end up poor. They might end up poor because of bad luck. They might end up poor because of bad judgment about investments they made. They might end up poor because they're in some way handicapped and can't put forth an effort that the market will reward. They might end up poor just because they're lazy. There are a variety of different reasons, but at the end of the day, the market is just going to say, you're poor. Similarly, there may be some people who are very richly rewarded. Again, it may be that some of them are highly skilled, some of them are just lucky, some of them are in the right place at the right time. And the market will reward them according to its impersonal forces of what they produce and of supply and demand. So when we think about supply and demand and these long-term decisions about investing in more skills and training and luck, we would expect any market economy to produce a certain amount of poverty and a certain amount of inequality. The question for us in this lecture is, what should we do about that? And how should we think about it in economic terms? Let's start off by talking some about poverty in the United States, and particularly about where the U.S. poverty line came from. The story is actually, I think, kind of a fun one. The poverty line is one of those things which can actually be traced to a single person. Her name is Molly Orshansky, and Molly worked at the Social Security Administration. One day, in about 1964, her boss came to Molly and said, Molly, make up a poverty line. Wasn't quite that simple, but that's basically what happened. They wanted to have some measure of poverty. There was no official government measure of poverty, and it was up to Molly to come up with some sort of idea of what a poverty line should be. So what she did was she took the following idea. She said, okay, I know that for a typical household at this time, about 30% of the household income is spent on food. I also know that if I go over to the Department of Agriculture, they have a list which tells me what's the basic nutritional plan for different families of different sizes. What's the basic nutritional plan for a family with 2 people, 3 people, 4 people, 5 people, and so on. So I'll figure out how much it costs to buy the food in the basic nutritional plan, and then I'll say that amount is 30% of the poverty line, since on average people spend 30% of their income on food. The nice thing about this approach was it was linked to something basic that people needed to buy, like food. And also, it was adjusted for the size of the family, so that families with larger numbers of people had a higher poverty line than families with smaller numbers, which makes some sense. And ever since then, what we've basically done, with a little bit of fiddling around the edges, is to take Molly Orshansky's poverty line as she invented it, and to raise it up each year by the amount of inflation, so that the poverty line has steadily gone up with the inflation rate, but that's basically how it's been adjusted over time. Now, I think Orshansky's poverty line is interesting and useful and a useful way to think about things, but like any statistic, there are an awful lot of questions you can ask about it and a lot of hard questions you can ask about whether it's a sensible way of measuring poverty. Let me suggest a few of those questions so you have a sense of some of the criticisms that come up all the time about the poverty line. One criticism. Back when Orshansky was putting the poverty line together, food was about 30% of the average family budget. But as society's gotten richer and richer over the last several decades, the amount of family budgets going to food has gone down and down and down and down. And now food is something like about 12% of the typical family budget. Now, if you think about how she put together her poverty line, take a certain amount of food and then multiply it up, If food had only been 12% of the poverty line when she did that, the poverty line would be much higher than it is now. So there's a question about how is that set up? Is it properly linked to the basic necessities that people need to buy? And is food enough of a link all by itself? Second thing is that while we've had the poverty line adjusted upwards over time, as inflation went up and up and up, it has not been adjusted upward over time for society getting richer. In other words, it's been adjusted for the inflationary gains to the economy, but it has not been adjusted for the real gains. Perhaps it should be. Perhaps it should be adjusted to go upward for the real gains as well as the inflationary ones. A third problem. There's a lot of diversity in this society. There are poor people living in rural areas. There are poor people living in urban areas. There are poor people in high-cost states like New York or California. There are poor people in low-cost states like West Virginia or Mississippi. Does it really make sense to have a poverty line which somehow lumps all of those people into one big category? They do make some adjustments in the poverty line for big regions of the country, but they don't make sort of local adjustments for what's your local cost of living or your local standard of living. And the result is that the poverty line in some places might look very high, partly just because the whole standard of living is lower in that state. The poverty line is a cash line. It takes into account the amount of income one has, but it does not take into account things like in-kind benefits. When I talk about in-kind benefits, what I'm referring to are benefits which are not delivered in a monetary form, but instead are delivered in the form of some sort of benefit like food stamps, where it's certainly worth something, you can buy food with it, but it's not in cash form to you. The two most important in-kind benefits in our current system of welfare and support for the poor would be food stamps and Medicaid assistance. And again, Medicaid assistance is something that it's not cash to the person directly, so it doesn't count as part of what your income, but it's certainly worth something. If you had to buy that insurance yourself for a family of two or three, it would probably cost you several thousand dollars a year. So the poverty line says how many people are below the cash poverty line, but it's not officially adjusted for how much in-kind assistance people receive in forms like Medicaid or food stamps. Also, any poverty line has a certain amount of arbitrariness to it. I mean, think about it for a moment. There's a certain line somewhere, and they have this line in place. And that means if you're a dollar above that line, you're not poor, and if you're a dollar below that line, you're poor. Now, most things in the real world don't change quite that quickly. Poverty is more sort of a gradation, a shades of gray kind of thing, rather than it is a up $1, down $1 kind of thing. So even thinking about a particular poverty line is in some sense a bit of a difficult conceptual exercise. I make all these points. I think they're all valid points. They're worth thinking about when someone tells you the poverty amount is X or Y, how much poverty is in the United States. But I also don't want to overstate them. There is enormous value in having a poverty statistic which you can compare over time and which represents something that hasn't conceptually changed over long periods of time. If we were every year to be redefining what poverty is and adding some of these things and subtracting some of these things and putting them in and putting them out, then the poverty rate would be going up and down, but it would have more to do with how we calculate the number than with the concept of the number itself. Even if the number is arbitrary, and it is arbitrary to some extent, there's something good about an arbitrary number. The arbitrariness of it gives you a solid standard that you can look at year after year. And as long as you bear in mind what the strengths and weaknesses are of that number, then there's nothing terrible about arbitrariness. You can just sort of accept it and move on and don't overstate what the number means. Perhaps the most radical sorts of proposals that have been made about the poverty line are proposals that instead of having it be a dollar amount, which is adjusted each year for inflation, that perhaps instead it should be a proportion of overall income. For example, we could say that we'll take the median income in the United States, the income right in the middle of the distribution, and the poverty line would be half of that median income level. So it would automatically move up and down with the income of society as a whole. The difficulty with that point of view, if you think about it some, is that it means that it would be very difficult to discover if we were actually winning the war against poverty. Because if you always have some sort of a distribution, and the poverty line is always moving up as the distribution moves up, you may never be able to fix poverty. You may have sort of defined it as always being a certain percentage of the population. For public policy terms, and for the sake of helping the poor, that doesn't seem useful. It seems useful to have some standard of poverty which represents a real standard of living that you'd like people to have to try and meet. There is a recent proposal by the National Academy of Sciences, a panel they convened, more accurately, where they suggested that we should sort of update Orshansky's way of thinking. But instead of just using food, we should use food, shelter, clothing, other basic necessities of life, and we should base a poverty line on all of those things. And we could adjust that poverty line around the country, to some extent, based on how much those things cost in different places. And there are proposals out there, proposals before Congress, to adjust the poverty line in that way. I think there's probably some value to doing that conceptually, but I am leery about any time you adjust and redefine statistics, how it tends to become a political game. I can easily see that people on one side of the political fence would want to redefine all those numbers so the poverty rates looked lower. People on the other side of the fence would be trying to redefine it so it looked higher. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that what I get is something that I really understand better than I understand the basic poverty line now. So it's worth remembering what the poverty line is. It's worth remembering these strengths and weaknesses, but I wouldn't perhaps overstate precisely what it means in terms of gathering up or capturing the idea of poverty. Well, given the poverty line, what do we know about it in basic terms? The overall level of poverty in the mid-90s has been around 13 or 14% of the population. That's the percentage of the population which is below the poverty line. If we think about the actual amounts that put you below the poverty line, for a family of three people, the poverty line in 1995, was $12,158. So if you were below that amount, you were poor, and if you were above that amount, you weren't poor. The amount varied for each different family size. And if you sort of work it out, the amount for one person, the poverty line for one person in 1995, was about $8,000. For two people, it was 29% more than that. For three people, it was 53% above the amount for one person. And in fact, if you had nine people in your family, the poverty line in 1995 was $31,000. So the poverty line moves quite a bit according to how big your family size is, and that sort of gives you a sense maybe of where the poverty line is coming from. The main change in poverty over the years has been, if you look at a graph going back to the 1950s or so, that poverty rates were extremely high in the 1950s. If you take Molly Orshansky's poverty line and project it backwards into the 1950s, you see that poverty rates in the 1950s would have been something like 30%. They would have been extremely high for the country as a whole. But the rapid economic growth of the 50s and 1960s brings the poverty line down into the range of about 10 or 11%. Then in the 1970s, as we get several recessions, 1980s, several recessions, more recent economic growth, poverty rate sort of goes up and down as the economy goes up and down, but it tends to stay in a range, sort of in bad years, about 15%, in good years, maybe 12%, and ricocheting back and forth between those two. What the overall level hides, though, is a change in the composition of poverty over time. If you were to ask in the 1950s or 1960s, who is poor? Give me a one-word answer, the answer would have been elderly. That old people were poor and poor people tended to be old folks to a disproportionate degree. If you were to ask that same question in the 1990s, who are the poor? Give me a short answer. The short answer would be single women with children. The elderly, by and large, have been lifted out of poverty with the help of Social Security and Medicare and other kinds of programs to support the elderly. But single women with kids now make up a disproportionate number, a very large number, of the people who are below the poverty line in this country. When we think about the problem of poverty, we sort of need to take into account who's poor. Before talking about what we might do about poverty, though, let me first switch over and talk about how we measure inequality. When you think about measuring inequality, what you want to do is split the entire income distribution into groups and then say how much of income goes to each particular group. For example, we could split the income distribution into tenths, or we could split it into 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%. An easy way to do it, in a way that reveals most of the lessons I want to get across without being too complicated, is to split the income distribution into fifths. So bottom fifth, second fifth, third fifth, and on up to the top fifth. If you look at the statistics for 1995, and these statistics are all as a few years late in coming out, the lowest one-fifth, the lowest 20% of the income distribution, had 4.4% of the total income in that year. The next 20%, that is from 21% up to 40% of the income distribution, that 20% had a total of 10.1% of the income distribution. So if you add up those two, the bottom fifth and the next fifth, and you add up the amounts they have, you would find that the bottom 40% of the income distribution had about 15% of the total income. The third fifth of the income distribution, that is the middle group from the 41st percentile up to the 60th percentile, that 20% had 15.8% of the total income in 1995. And now if we add up the bottom three groups, the first, second, and third, the bottom 60% of the U.S. income distribution had 30% of the total income that year. The fourth, fifth, the fourth quintile, as economists like to say, had 23.2% of the income in 1995, and the top 20% had 46.5% of the income in 1975. If you break down that top 20% even further and you look just at the top 5%, the top 5% had 20% of all the income earned in the U.S. in 1995. Now, you can break this up a number of different ways, you know, percentile-wise and so on, but no matter how you break it up, you get fundamentally the same answer. The same answer is that if you go back to about 1980, go back to 1970, 1960, 1950, and you look at these kinds of percentages for what the different fifths of the income distribution have, what you see is, going back to really the 1930s or even a little earlier, there is a remarkable stability in the income distribution. That the bottom fifth always has about the same percentage, and the top fifth always has about the same percentage, and it moves just a very little bit year to year to year. By 1980, though, you begin to see a dramatic change. And by the mid-80s, the change has become evident to just about everyone. The change is that the top fifth and the top 5% in particular are increasing their share of the income they typically receive. Up until then, it was common for the top fifth to receive about 41 or 42% of all the income. And as I said a moment ago, now the top fifth is receiving something more like 46% of all the income. So they've increased their proportion by about 5 percentage points. Now, almost all of that increase is represented by a gain to the top 5%. Why did this happen? What's going on here? The common answer, especially when given by a lot of Democrats during the 1980s, was it must be Reagan's fault. We elected a conservative Republican president. Things got more unequal. It must be Reagan's fault. Most economists don't believe that. They don't come remotely close to believing it. There are several arguments which argue that whatever is going on here, it's really not Reagan's fault. The most obvious thing is that although Reagan did, for example, cut taxes and cut some welfare benefits to some extent, all of that stuff has to do with what you have after taxes are paid and after your benefits are received from various social welfare programs. Now, the change in inequality that happened doesn't have to do with after taxes are paid, after benefits are received. The change in inequality has to do with the wages that are actually paid. The wages themselves became more unequal in the first place, regardless of what happened after that in terms of taxes and welfare benefits. Now, we can blame Reagan for changing taxes and welfare benefits if you're in a mood to blame Reagan for something, but you can't blame him for controlling wages in the economy. Wages presumably moved for other reasons having to do with forces of supply and demand in some way that we would need to seek out some underlying economic explanation. The second reason why people don't believe that it was probably Ronald Reagan is that this same trend toward inequality is perceived all around the world. It's perceived in countries across Europe, in Germany, in France, in the United Kingdom. It's also perceived in third world countries like Mexico and Brazil. Now, we may again, if you're in a mood to blame Ronald Reagan for something, blame him for what happens in the U.S. economy. It is more difficult to blame him for a global trend that reaches out to all the different countries of the world. A third thing that made it a little more difficult to blame Reagan is that even after Reagan left office, and after Bush left office, and after Bill Clinton entered office, the trend toward inequality continued, and continued, and continued. And so, if you're in the mood to blame someone, blaming whoever's president for what's going on, the Democrats sort of uncomfortably found that if you're going to blame the president, well, now you have to be blaming a Democratic president for what's going on. And that seemed to make them believe that probably it wasn't the president's fault after all, but rather it was the fault of other economic factors that we would need to sort out. Well, what are these other economic factors? Economists have struggled with this question a great deal over the last 5 to 10 years. And I guess the short answer for what they've come up with is that what
is going on in the economy is an increase in the returns to education and an increase in the returns to certain kinds of skills. That what's really happening in the economy is that people who have certain kinds of high-powered skills which work well in the global economy are getting paid more for those skills than they were before. If you look at some factors like the returns to a college education, how much do you get in return for the investment you make in a college education? You see that it's going up and up in the 1980s and 1990s. The returns to education seem higher and higher. The returns to technology seem higher and higher. And so when you think about those factors, that's sort of an underlying thing which you could understand applying to many countries across the world, driving up wages all over the world, being something that would affect wages, and something that would be continuing over a period of time. There's a lot of argument back and forth over exactly how this works because the details are not at all clear. But what preliminary evidence does exist seems to be that you can kind of think of skills in the U.S. economy and inequality as kind of in a race with each other. And the way I sometimes think about this is that in the time after World War II, when we had the GI Bill, there's enormous surge in college enrollments. There's a lot more skilled workers in the economy. And one of the things you see at that time is that inequality doesn't go up very much. Presumably, we need more and more skill, but we had more and more skilled workers. So the supply of skilled workers was keeping pace with demand. Then the number of skilled workers drops off a little bit in the 1950s. We don't get as rapid an increase as we were getting before. And when we don't get as rapid an increase in skilled workers, then the demand for skilled workers rises more quickly than the supply, and things become more unequal again. In the 1960s, one of the things you see is a surge of college enrollments, probably having to do with getting deferments from fighting in the Vietnam War. But as a result, you see a big surge in college enrollment again, and you don't see very much inequality at all, because even though there's more demand for skilled labor, the supply of skilled labor is keeping up. What seems to be happening in the last few years is that although we're still having, a lot of college graduates, we're not having the same dramatic increases. So we're having more and more demand for skilled labor as technology continues on and on and on, but we're not getting the supply of skilled labor we need to catch up. The implication would be that if we really want to fight inequality, one of the ways to think about it would be to somehow increase the amount of skilled labor we've got in the economy. Well, let me ask the sort of question that perhaps only an economist can ask. And that question is inequality bad? With poverty, we can somehow say, yeah, we think it's bad. We can say that in a fairly direct way. Because after all, we're talking about people who don't have basic necessities of life. And we can say those people are suffering. But inequality is, at least to me, a trickier business. Because a lot of the time, if you just look at any one given year, I would expect to see a certain amount of inequality out there in the economy. What are some of the potential reasons? Well, one, for example, is just that most people go through what economists refer to as the life cycle for their income. And if you think about how most people earn income, you start out early, say in your 20s, and you have a job that maybe doesn't pay a whole lot. Then you get promoted, or you get a graduate degree, or you work your way up, and you get some experience. Then maybe in your 30s and your 40s and 50s, you're earning higher and higher income. Then at some point, you retire and move on. Well, if we just take a snapshot of that at some point in time, then we would be saying, well, of course there are some people who earn a lot of money. Those are people in their 40s and 50s who worked their way up the ladder. And of course there are some people who don't earn very much money. Those are retired people and people who are in their 20s and 30s. No big shock that we've got some unemployment there. You just expect that if you're looking at a diverse group of people over time. If that's where the inequality is coming from, then I wouldn't worry a heck of a lot about it. Related to this idea of the life cycle, there's a certain amount of mobility in the income distribution. People move from the bottom fifth up to the next fifth, up to the next fifth. Some people who are rich lose their money and get poor again. In some ways, I care more about whether there's mobility than about whether there's inequality. If I know that out of those people who are poor today, many of them have a pretty good shot to be middle class, then I worry less about poverty. I sort of think, well, it's a temporary thing, and in a market economy, some stuff like that's going to happen. On the other hand, if people seem to be trapped at the bottom level all through their lives, and perhaps even worse, if they seem to be intergenerationally trapped, that the children of poor people are sort of doomed to be poor people themselves, then I begin to worry more about inequality. But the question of how much mobility there is up and down the income distribution is clearly important to thinking about how much we care. It's also true, although it's not always popular to say, that a certain amount of inequality is just due to choice on people's part. My wife, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, got a business school degree. She's, I think, not a crazed person about money and work, but some of our friends are crazed people. There's a friend of ours in New York City who works for an investment bank, and for a while, her schedule at that investment bank involved not only working 6 days a week, but two of those days, she would work through the night. So her normal weekly schedule was to show up Monday morning, work through Monday night, leave Tuesday night, come back Wednesday morning, work through Wednesday night, leave Thursday night, work Friday, and then work on Saturday as well. Now, this person is making a bucket of money. I mean, they are making money hand over fist. They're making, I'm sure, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more. Do I begrudge them a penny of that money? No. I mean, they're crazy, and that's okay. The market allows them to be crazy, but it's not something where I would say, well, you know, it's unfair. I mean, they're working 90 or 100 hours a week. They're working the equivalent of 2.5 jobs. You know, more power to them. It's not a life I want, but it's their choice. Conversely, in academia, there are a lot of very, very smart people who made a different choice. Very, very smart people who said, you know, what I'd really like is a job where I teach some, but really my summers are my own. I have school holidays. I have a lot of freedom. I have a lot of autonomy. I'm not going to get a law degree and make a bunch of money. I'm not going to get an MBA degree and make a bunch of money. I'm going to make a moderate salary. I'm going to live in campus housing. And that's their choice. And it's perfectly fine that they make that choice. And I don't think, when I look at those people, well, gee, I really think that, you know, we should take a lot of money from my investment banker friend and redistribute it to those people to get rid of inequality. I mean, everybody has choices to make in this life, and if you make those choices, well, so be it. I mean, that's how it is. Inequality also talks to some extent about what the incentives are people have to work. If you have some ability to work your way up the ladder, then your incentives to work hard are much greater than if you have some sense that I'm going to show up for work every day, I'm going to make minimum wage, minimum wage, minimum wage, I'm never going to go anyplace. So this idea of sort of mobility and whether or not you can move and whether or not you have some choices about where you end up all kind of tie together and relate to a question of whether or not in our society as a whole you've got some ability to move up and down the ladder. So I guess all of this in some ways says that although there is a lot of inequality here, I wouldn't worry about it, some of it. Some amount of inequality makes perfect sense in the world we live in, and you just wouldn't want to get too excited about it. But that said, the trend toward greater inequality in the last 15 years, and remember, that trend breaks a 50-year pattern of inequality being about the same over time. The trend toward greater inequality seems to me bothersome. It's not bothersome so much on economic grounds, at least not to me, but it's really bothersome more on this notion of what does it mean to live in a common society? What does it mean to live in a tightly knit society? And do people feel like they've got some chance of participating in the good things of society? When we're in a world where a smaller and smaller group are getting a higher and higher proportion of the returns, then that's something that I think has to worry us a little bit in terms of whether our society holds together well. The United States has been historically very, very lucky in the sense that it's been a country without serious class conflict. It's been a country where the poor didn't seem to say, we're poor and we need to attack the middle class and the rich. Instead, it's been a country where everyone said they were middle class. In fact, poor people think they're middle class and rich people think they're middle class. Everyone sort of feels like they're part of some big middle class. And the amount of conflict, the amount of angst, the amount of pressure put on things is very much less as a result. Greater inequality threatens that American exceptionalism to some extent. It's something to worry about in that light. Well, let's say that we're worried about poverty, and let's say for the sake of argument that we're worried about addressing inequality, or at least some of the inequality that's happened. What can we do about it? Let's first talk about policies for addressing poverty. I'm going to suggest a range of possibilities here, some of which will make more sense to me and perhaps to you, given the other lectures, than others. One possible way of addressing poverty is set prices for necessities. In other words, if poor people need to buy affordable housing, they need to buy food, they need to buy clothes, they need to buy medical care, then we'll set prices for those things. We'll have rent control for housing, we'll have guaranteed cheap food, we'll have Medicaid to provide low-cost medical care, we'll have other kinds of subsidies to assure that things are low price. Well, as you could probably guess from the earlier lectures, it's not a big guess, Most economists are not very much in favor of this. The main difficulty comes that when you start setting prices saying, I want to help the 14% of the population who's poor, you're also affecting the incentives of everyone who produces those goods, as well as the 86% of the population that's not poor. So if we want to help the poor, let's target in and focus the poor. Let's not sort of attack the price as if the price were the problem. I remember someone once saying, an economist once said, isn't it unfair that housing markets make prices so high to the poor? Isn't it unfair to the poor? And this fellow said, well, it's not housing markets that are unfair to the poor. Life is unfair to the poor. The problem is life. It's not to try and adjust the price one way or another. We need to think a little bigger than that. So this notion that one way of addressing poverty is to set prices for necessities is something that most economists would really rather not see. Second possibility. Rather than setting prices for things people buy, let's set wage floors. In particular, let's think about a high minimum wage. For example, one thing that's been proposed by some people is, okay, let's take this poverty line for three people. It's about $12,000. Well, $12,000, if you work 40 hours a week for 50 weeks out of a year, you would work 2,000 hours a year. So, 12,000 divided by 2,000 hours a year means if the minimum wage was $6 an hour, then someone could earn enough at a minimum wage job to make it to the poverty line for a family of three. The mathematics there is impeccable. The arithmetic works. But that sort of solution also raises a lot of difficult questions. I mean, that works perfectly well for a family with three people. But does that mean that we should have the same minimum wage for a teenager who has no family at all? What are we going to do for the family with four people, or five people, or six people, or seven people? Are we going to have the wage you get paid depend on the number of kids you have? Businesses are not going to be real thrilled about that. And in fact, if you want to try and get people hired who have large families, you can't say, well, if you hire this person, you have to pay them more because they have five kids, and this person, you pay them less because they have two kids. It's just not a practical solution. Moreover, there's these wide disparities in what the poverty rate means in different parts of the country. So when we think about trying to raise a wage floor, trying to guarantee some sort of a minimum wage, I think the great difficulty there, besides all the problems of the minimum wage we talked about before, is really its extraordinary lack of flexibility. Unless we're going to try and build in different wage floors for different people according to where they live and their family status, it's not really much of a solution for poverty at all. Third possibility. Rather than setting a wage floor, let's either give people income directly or subsidize their wages. Giving income directly is something we do now through what used to be the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, AFDC, was reformed during the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. It has a different acronym now, TANF. I've forgotten what that stands for. But basic welfare payments are just cash. You just give them to people, and then they've got the cash. We could also think about various ways of subsidizing wages. I mentioned in an earlier lecture the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit is a way of giving people more income based on how many hours they worked. And you're only eligible for this particular tax credit depending on whether or not you actually have a family. So that avoids the problem of what about teenagers or what about other groups. You could also have a situation where employers are given some sort of a subsidy to hire low-wage workers. And by giving employers the subsidy, then you would encourage them to pay more and not to lay folks like that off. Those kinds of solutions work to some extent. They run into a fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem really works like this. When you think about giving people income, the difficult part of the problem is that you also have to think about withdrawing that income. In other words, how much income do you take away from someone when they get a regular job? If you're giving someone, say, $600 a month, and they start earning $300 a month, do you keep giving them the $600 a month, or do you start cutting back on that amount? Well, typically, most people say, well, you have to start cutting back on it to some extent, but when you do start cutting back on it, then you're removing their incentives to work. You're saying, hey, right now you're getting $600 a month for not working. But if you go and earn $300 a month, we'll cut you back to $300 a month. So now you get $600 a month for working. Well, given that choice, $600 a month for working or $600 for not working, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to say that the incentives really are to not take a job. And in fact, that's the way most welfare programs tend to work right now. That as you earn money, they subtract dollar for dollar how much you earn. And by subtracting dollar for dollar how much you earn, they remove any incentive to earn money. It doesn't seem a very productive way to proceed. The alternative of subsidizing wages can also run into various problems. If you start giving subsidies to employers, how do you know for sure those get passed along? Who gets classified as being low income or high income? How do you deal with these various problems? I think a lot of economists are in favor of some of these things of subsidizing wages. They believe it's sort of a way out of this trap of taking away a dollar for every dollar someone earns. But it's hard to figure out just what the right subsidy is and how to do something like that in such a way that it's not extraordinarily expensive. A conservative economist named Edward Phelps recently wrote a book proposing a wage subsidy program. And this is a conservative kind of guy, wouldn't normally, you know, argue for big interventions in the market. But his wage subsidy plan, which I say is not particularly generous, would cost about $100 billion a year. So when you start thinking about wage subsidies, you have to start thinking big dollars in a hurry. And that's difficult to think about. So where do we turn from this in-kind help subsidizing wages? A fourth general approach to fixing poverty would be, well, let's think about in-kind assistance. Let's think about things like Medicaid and food stamps. The nice thing about Medicaid and food stamps for a lot of people, when they think about these programs, is that Medicaid and food stamps seem like you're giving something that's useful to people. The worry is always that if you give people income, if you just give them welfare payments, they might spend that money in some foolish way. They might spend it all on cigarettes or alcohol or something like that. That's certainly the stereotype. But if you give them medical care, or if you give them food stamps, then you sort of feel as if, well, they can't, that's just good stuff. It's just helping people who need help. So we're sort of getting out of that problem that they might spend the money foolishly or badly. The great difficulty in thinking about Medicaid and food stamps and this in-kind assistance is if you go one step deeper, the effects of these programs may be very different than you expect. For example, imagine you give somebody food stamps. You might say, okay, well, that's just helping them spend food, and we'll have rules that say they can't spend it on cigarettes or alcohol or other things. Fair enough. But even if you spend food stamps on those items, the fact that you gave them food stamps means that now other money is freed up. And they can spend the other money on whatever they want. I mean, effectively, the food stamps, you might as well just give them cash in the first place. All it does is free up cash to spend on other things. So this feeling like we're controlling them, we're only letting them spend the money on food, is just a complete illusion. When we think about Medicaid, something similar happens. We're giving people help with Medicaid, but think about it for a moment. If you were a poor person, I mean a really poor person, you're below the poverty line, you've got several kids, medical care certainly matters to you. But if you only had $8,000 a year in income, would you spend $3,000 of it on health insurance for your kids? That's a tough call. I mean, if you have hardly any money, you might be an awful lot happier getting at least some of that in the form of cash that you could actually spend on things that you need for day-to-day living, rather than having it all saved up to go off to doctors for a healthcare plan that, while it's very useful, might be more expensive than you really need at the end of the day. Moreover, if you give people Medicaid when they're poor, but then you take it away after they get a job, you put people in a very awkward situation. You put them in a situation where if they go out and get work and the job doesn't have healthcare benefits, then their kids have lost their health care insurance. There's a lot of mothers out there who would be very hesitant to take a job if it meant that their kids were going to lose their health care coverage. So this idea that we can just give people in-kind aid and it won't really affect the other stuff is a real illusion. You have to think through the consequences of those kinds of things. The most recent experience with what we should do to fight poverty is what we might call workfare. Workfare has been around for quite a while. I think really it starts in about 1988 with some bills passed under the Reagan administration, and then more bills passed under the Bush administration, and then most recently with the Welfare Reform Act under the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration bill goes the furthest, and the proposal there has been to just say we're going to put a limit on how long people can receive welfare. Sure, we'll give them some assistance, we'll give them retraining, we'll give them income, but we're going to put a lifetime limit on it of about 2 years. And nobody can get it for more than 2 years total over their life. once you've used up your 2 years, then you just wouldn't get support anymore. We'll also require that people go to work, require that they go to job training. We'll try and force them back into the economy in that way. Now, in general, I don't have a big problem with the notion that we should be pushing people back into the labor market as much as possible. There are a lot of poor folks who receive welfare who've said that it's something that long-term really strips your dignity and your self-respect, and I think we should be trying to help people get back into the paid workforce. However, I'm not overly optimistic about this welfare reform bill that's been passed. The evidence we have on job training and retraining tends to be that it does work fairly well for one particular group, and that is welfare mothers who are now over the age of 25. What seems to happen in people's lives, if I can simplify a little bit, is that when you're a teenager and in your early 20s, retraining doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference to you because you just don't have the discipline to stick with it. However, once you get to about age 25, then you get into a situation where people say, you know, my life's really not going anyplace here. I'm growing up, I gotta get a handle on things, I gotta pull things together. And at that point, job training for women with kids seems to work relatively well. That you actually get some progress, people can get good jobs. We don't know how to train young poor men. We don't have any particular evidence of any program that really makes a big difference in their earning prospects. After all, think about it. A lot of these poor folks are people who've had a terrible time all the way through school. They've been going through the school system year after year after year. Many of them might be illiterate. They might have substance abuse problems. They might have socialization problems. They might have criminal records. And then you're going to say, well, we'll put them in a six-month program, and in 6 months, they'll be ready for a middle-class job. I don't think so. It's going to take a heck of a lot more than that. It's going to be a much more costly thing to do. That's not to say it's not worth trying or doing, but we don't know how to do it right now. And we need to experiment more with different kinds of programs and methods where we might be able to actually train some folks. Right now, the workfare program looks like a great success because the upswing in the economy has diminished the number of poor people, taken a lot of people off welfare, and probably it's kicked off some people who didn't really need to be on it anyway. But when we hit the next recession, and as we start working down toward those poor people who really are, in some ways, not very employable, I think we're going to have some very hard cases where people are going to run into that 2-year limit. And the ultimate question is not, what about the person who you cut off? It's, what about their kids? Are you really willing to let kids suffer because their parent can't get their act together and get a job? And that'll be a very difficult question we'll face a few years down the road. Let's think briefly about policies to affect the amount of inequality in the economy. They're really just two broad approaches. One is what I call the ladder of opportunity. And the idea of the ladder of opportunity is just that if everyone starts off with a pretty good chance of success in society, they start off with pretty good schools, pretty good family, pretty good diet, and they have a pretty good chance to do what they want and be what they want to be, then in some ways, I don't think inequality is a big problem. If everyone's got a ladder of opportunity, then I think that's a legitimate way to think about justice in society. And in fact, there are a lot of groups that have done very well in terms of moving up the social ladder in that way. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, where I'm from, there are a group of refugees from Laos, the Hmong who came over after the Vietnam War. Many of these folks came over not speaking any English, with essentially no literacy, no skills for the Western industrialized world. An awful lot of their kids, in a very, very short period of time, went through high school, learned English, got college degrees, and are out there working. It's really sort of phenomenal when you think about it. It's just amazing. I don't know that I would have the same fortitude if I were in the same situation. However, it also seems true that in our economy and in our society, there are a lot of people who don't have an equal step in the ladder of opportunity. They grow up in dysfunctional families, dysfunctional neighborhoods. They go to cruddy schools. And then, at about age 15 or 16, it's no wonder that their lives are kind of a mess. And if we're going to think about helping those people, most of the social science research that's out there suggests we need to start helping them really early. And by really early, I mean like age 2 or 3. If you wait until kids are 13 or 14 and then you try and fix up their lives for them, there's just not a heck of a lot you can do about it. People's life patterns get set very young. A second set of policies to affect inequality and reduce inequality would be basically taxes and redistribute the money to the poor. Tax the rich, give the money to the poor. You can think of this as the Robin Hood approach. We actually do less of this in the United States than a lot of people think we do. If you look at all the taxes in the U.S. economy, including sales taxes, income taxes, social security taxes, they are pretty much proportionally distributed. The rich pay more of some taxes, but the poor pay more of some taxes too, like sales taxes and social security taxes. Right now, we don't do a heck of a lot of redistribution, but the argument is typically that redistribution is difficult to do without affecting people's incentives. If you take too much money from the rich, you start discouraging them from working, which you would like to do to sort of move the economy forward, have more invention, have more innovation, have hard workers. If you give the poor too much, you may reduce incentives to work in various ways. So there's kind of a delicate balance that we need to observe. But I think that we probably could stand to take a little bit more from the rich, who after all have benefited so greatly from the last 15 years and the rise in inequality, and distribute some of that money in the form of wage subsidies to the working poor, who really are out there working. They're working full time. It's just that the wages they're making are not very high for supporting their families. Is fighting inequality and poverty economically essential, or is it sort of a human kind of thing to do? There are a lot of people who have made the argument that somehow it should be economically important to fight inequality and poverty. We'll build a broad middle class. We'll have more workers. We'll have better incentives. And, you know, I wish all that were true. I wish it was true that you could make a really good argument that it's good for the economy to be have less poverty or less inequality. But at the end of the day, I just don't believe it. I think that the real reason to reduce poverty is that poverty is a bad thing. And we should reduce it because it's a bad thing and because people are suffering. I think also the reason we should reduce inequality has to do with society being pulled apart a little bit more. It may not make a huge difference to the growth of the economy over time, but it seems to me nonetheless the right thing to do.